Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I remember the first time I saw Yes magazine in a supermarket checkout line. It was about 20 years ago, and okay, yes, it was Whole Foods. I was so thrilled to find a publication with positive stories about change, rather than the steady diet of gloom and doom that was my usual reading fare. My guest, Sarah Van Gelder, is a co-founder of Yes. But even someone who's been bringing stories about solutions instead of just problems to the public can get depressed sometimes, looking around at the enormous challenges we face in this world and this country. From economic to environmental meltdowns, the crises are overwhelming. But her new book, The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America, is filled with inspiring stories of ordinary Americans working together to confront power, take it back, and make their communities better. The issues they face range from threats to their land and water, workplaces closing down, and poor access to healthy and adequate food and housing, and more. Let's start with a reading by Sarah Van Gelder from The Revolution Where You Live, which she recorded for Writer's Voice.
At the root of these issues, I think, is a system of beliefs and a power structure that allow big corporations and their enablers in government to extract wealth from our natural world and from our communities. A worldview that devalues people of color and turns their land, labor, and bodies into extractable resources is also part of the picture. Until recently, many white Americans believed they would benefit from this system of corporate capitalism, or at least be immune from its worst excesses. But big corporations and the neoliberal policies they endorse have undermined the foundations of the middle class and turned mountaintops, waterways, and urban neighborhoods in the United States into sacrifice zones. They've rolled over small businesses with big box stores, our homes with predatory lending, our schools with privatization schemes, and our medical care with bloated drug costs. Plus, they pushed on us food laden with chemical additives, genetically modified organisms, and antibiotics, which are creating resistant strains of diseases that may soon make routine ailments into life-threatening catastrophes. To tolerate this, we learn to numb ourselves, binge-watching television series, taking drugs, or overeating. We separate ourselves emotionally from our communities, from the natural world, even from ourselves. Schools teach us this, as does advertising. We learn to accept the demise of beloved outdoor spaces and of wild species. Maybe our obsession with cute animal videos is an emotional compensation for the pain of losing the diverse forms of life that wink out on a daily basis. We learn to leave family or community to chase down a better job, to leave our children in sterile childcare centers because we have to earn a few dollars working a low-wage job. We learn from watching nonstop images of violence in the media that other people are not trustworthy. And we learn to use stuff to fill the hole left by isolation and to disassociate from our deepest values. We adopt the values of consumerism and learn to live vicariously via celebrities and to accept the illnesses that come from stress, toxins, and bad food. I'm not sure why we allow all this. I think it must be because we are exhausted by trying to get by. Many people are deep in debt and work multiple jobs to pay the rent. And we're mesmerized by corporate media, and we are isolated. When we lose our connections to each other, we lose our power. We believe we can't change things and can't remake our world. We lose the ability to create an economy together, and we become dependent on big corporations for our livelihoods. And we become less able to resist advertising messages that tell us we are only worth what we can buy. Our isolation, when coupled with economic hardship, makes us vulnerable to the hate speech of demagogues. When we disconnect from the natural world, we lose a grounding, a sense of belonging to a larger community of life, as well as an experience of the wildness and freedom we share with our cousins of other species.
Sarah Van Gelder, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is just a terrific book, a much needed remedy to the despair that is so easy. It's so easy for one to feel these days of the revolution where you live. Now, you spent nearly 5 months traveling 12,000 miles around the United States. You visited 18 states, 5 Indian reservations, 5 industrial cities, and some small towns. Why?
Well, we've been publishing Yes Magazine for 20 years, and some of the big questions that we had when we started, I was actually feeling were even more pressing now. I'm thinking about things like climate change, the climate crisis, which is rolling out even more quickly than climate scientists anticipated. I'm thinking about things like inequality. We now have something like 20 people in the United States who own as much wealth as half the American population. And I'm thinking about things like racism. You know, we thought, some people thought that maybe having an African-American president was going to take us past this horrible legacy we have of slavery, Jim Crow, lynching, all the things that are part of our American legacy in terms of racism. And of course, that didn't happen. Racism is still every bit as much present in American society. So after 20 years of doing this work, I just thought, you know, is this really working? Are we really making progress? And if not, where are the sources of progress? Because YES was founded to find solutions. And, you know, and I had to ask myself, were we looking in the right places? So I happened to be in Oakland, California. I walked into the office of a friend of mine, Akaya Windwood, and I told her what I was thinking about. And she asked this great question. She said, so if the universe could deploy the one small person that is you, what would it have you do? And I thought about that for just a second. And I said, I think I'd go out and look for myself. And it hadn't occurred to me until she asked that maybe this was the time to just get out of my comfort zone, get out onto the road, and actually visit places where change might be happening and ask those questions.
One of the great things that Yes Magazine does, in fact, is show the alternatives. I mean, there is so much of what we do as activists, and especially now in this time of this horrible, government that has been taken over by the worst aspects, the worst parts of our society. We are resisting. You know, there's this whole resist movement. We are against the terrible things that are happening. But what Yes Magazine has always done is show the positive, the vision of what we can do. And I think that is so much of what this book, The Revolution Where You Live, does. And you talk about it about place-based economies. What's a place-based economy, and how is it different than the one we live in?
A place-based economy is simply an economy that's rooted in a community, in an actual physical location, and it's different than the corporate globalized economy. I'm somebody who loves travel. I love seeing other cultures. I love the people who come here from other cultures. I'm not a xenophobe. But I do think our economies belong rooted in place. I think the whole phenomenon of big transnational corporations who roam the world looking for the places where they can extract the most wealth, I think has been terribly destructive to American communities as well as communities around the world. So I think an economy that's place-based is one in which people have a long-term commitment to the community that they are part of. They're very familiar. They're the mom-and-pop businesses that have been in our communities for generations, where people take responsibility for the Boys and Girls Club and contribute to the local charities. And they recognize that their role as business people is not just to extract wealth, it's to be part of something larger, to be part of a human community, and also to be part of an ecological community. Because if you have that kind of a long-term relationship with a place, and you realize that your children and their grandchildren are also going to be relying on the resources of that place, I think you're less likely to, for example, clear-cut your local forest. You're more likely to say, you know, how can this forest sustain us over the long term through sustainable forestry practices? So it's that notion that business can be part of a human community and part of an ecological community, instead of almost a predator or a parasite on those communities, that I was really interested in looking at. And I was especially looking in the Rust Belt, because the Rust Belt has been so abandoned by the predatory economy, and there is some really wonderful creative work being done to rebuild the local economy.
Yeah, and I'd like to get back to the Rust Belt, because it was incredibly inspiring, some of the things you found there. But I'd like to start first with the community that you live in. You visited some Native American reservations, and you live on one yourself. Tell us the story of Chief Seattle's home, because that's where you live, where he lived at one time, and the fight for that land and for the park. Is it called the Suquamish Olala community?
The community is the Suquamish community. Our little group was called Suquamish Olala Neighbors. So we started back in 2001. I had just moved to the Suquamish Reservation. I was living in a part of the reservation that's predominantly white, and I moved there simply because I found a house that I could afford to live in. So that's why I moved there. I didn't have any real plans to become an activist. But what happened shortly after I moved in is some of my neighbors knocked on the door and said, you know, there's the tribe is trying to build housing down the street from us, and we have to stay united against the tribe. And so that was my wake-up call, because, of course, I believe that the tribe should have the right to build housing in their own community, in their own reservation, and anywhere for that matter, but particularly on their own reservation. And so I went to a community meeting where over 100 people were packed into the local church, and one after another were getting up and talking about how we didn't want, quote, those people in our neighborhood. And I was just shocked and appalled and hadn't realized that this was going on in the community I decided to call home. And so finally, after listening to this for a while, I spoke up and said, of course, I thought they had the right to build housing in their own neighborhood and their own reservation. And then I decided to leave the meeting a little early and left. And an elder followed me out. It turned out there was a tribal elder who had been listening to all of that. And he very calmly thanked me for talking. We exchanged greetings, and I went on my way. Shortly after that, though, Chief Seattle's grave was desecrated, and there were newspaper clippings from that particular struggle left strewn around at the gravesite. And I remember, you know, being new in town, I was sort of waiting for the normal human rights leaders, the church leaders, or somebody else to step up, and then I could get in behind them. But nobody was saying anything. Nobody was doing anything. And finally, I got back in touch with that elder, and between the two of us and other friends, we formed an organization called Suquamish Olala Neighbors to try to change that relationship, to try to change those conditions which were leading to so much hostility. So yeah, over the course of years, a number of years, we did some interesting things. We showed up at meetings, and when the folks who were actually my neighbors would come and say, well, the non-tribal community doesn't want this or doesn't like the tribe, we would say, well, that's maybe true of you, but there's actually more of us who are actually supportive of the tribe and their sovereign rights to build housing or to do their fisheries in their traditional ways or whatever the question was. And then at one point, there was an opportunity to reclaim some land that was on the reservation, the land where Chief Seattle's home used to be the largest longhouse in the whole region, 600, 900 feet long, the estimates vary, but a huge longhouse, historically really important, and it had become a state park. The tribe wanted to reclaim that land, and over the course of a couple of years, we worked with them, and we were able to get that done.
So you had white neighbors who were, in conflict with the people, the tribe that had been there, after all, for thousands of years. I think this shows some of the divide, or is resonant of the divide that we, you know, have become so aware of in this country, between those who see themselves in opposition to others versus those who may try to find a way to connect with each other. Were you able to build bridges with the non-tribal members? And what are some of the lessons that you learned about overcoming those divides?
Well, at first it was really difficult because there was such opposition. When we tried to get that land returned to the tribe, they were fighting us tooth and nail. bringing out people like right-wing shock jock radio hosts to try to, you know, make it into some kind of an outrage that the tribe should want this land back. I mean, they were trying all these different tactics. And our decision was simply to stand up for what we believed was right, but to always do that respectfully. So we didn't call people names. We didn't label them racist or, you know, we just kept on with what we felt was right and filling in the historic reasons why we thought that was the right thing to do. And the tribe also did something that the State Parks Commission recommended. They held a meeting in which they took comments from everybody in the community, including their opponents, about any concerns they had about how that land would be managed once it was transferred to the park. And we very carefully took notes from everybody. We collected their comments. But what we didn't do is we didn't create a platform where people could get up and make the same sort of incendiary comments they'd been making in the past. Instead, we had small groups meeting around tables and taking people's concerns very seriously about security or about upkeep or maintenance or any of those kinds of concerns. And that became part of a management plan for the use of that land. So on the one hand, we listened respectfully and avoided name-calling. But on the other hand, we did not back down from what was, in fact, the tribe's right, which was to reclaim their ancestral land and the land that they kept as part of the treaty process.
That's a great story. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Sarah Van Gelder of Yes Magazine about the book she has just come out with. It's a terrific book and very inspiring, The Revolution Where You Live. Now, you went on to visit other Native American reservations where people were also building bridges between different communities, between Native American and white communities. I was very struck, especially after, you know, just learning that Donald Trump is now reopening, you know, or trying to reinvigorate the Dakota Access Pipeline Project and the Keystone XL Pipeline Project. You traveled through Montana and North Dakota, where Native Americans and ranchers are working together to shut down fracking and mining. Tell us a little bit about what you found.
So north of Seattle, there's a reservation called the Lummi Reservation, and the tribe there was in the process of fighting a giant new coal export terminal. It would have been the largest in the country for exporting coal, presumably to Asian markets. And the Lummi tribe didn't want that coal terminal because it would have gone through their traditional lands and interfered with their treaty rights to fish. So they had been fighting this coal terminal, and I got curious about, well, where is all that new coal coming from? You know, in this day and age, they're actually going to be increasing production so much that they need an entirely new coal terminal. So I decided to go and find out. So I got in my pickup truck and camper, which I bought to take this journey, and traveled out to southeast Montana. And found out that the place where this mine was proposed was a place called the Otter Creek Valley. It's this lovely, pristine valley filled with ranches, quiet, really quiet place, right adjacent to the Custer National Forest. And I spent time out there. I camped on the land of a member of the Northern Cheyenne tribe, Elena Buffalo Spirit, and interviewed her and her family and ranchers. And what I learned is that this has been a long battle. These folks, the ranchers and the Native people, have been working together for years to try to keep this coal mine from going in. The coal mine would have required a railroad spur that would have gone along this beautiful, wild river, the Tongue River, that is adjacent to the reservation. So the tribe was really adhemently opposed to it. Elena was herself. She's a cancer survivor and doesn't want all the pollution that would come along with that new railroad line with, you know, many coal trains a day going by her land. And she also talked about the Bakken oil boom in North Dakota. There's so much oil being extracted, all that fracking going on, that's brought these huge influx of workers, which has brought with it crime and human trafficking and drug abuse and all sorts of problems for the Fort Berthold Reservation, which I visited afterwards. And she didn't want those kinds of issues coming into her land. So she and the ranchers, a local group of environmentalists, were all opposing this for very similar reasons. And the reasons really came down to this sense that they had inherited this beautiful landscape, this beautiful countryside, and beautiful clean water and air. And they felt this sacred responsibility to pass those things along to future generations intact, just as they had inherited them. So it was this beautiful combination of gratitude and humility for what you know, both the ranchers and the native people were blessed with, and the sense that they were responsible that their children and grandchildren should also be blessed with similar kind of landscape.
And then you also visited the Turtle Mountain Reservation. Is that what it's called? Tell us about that. There was a fight to protect the water because women protect the water. Talk about the role of women and the whole issue of fracking that happened there.
Sure. But one thing I should mention about the Montana situation is after I got home, I learned that the mine had been turned down. The Arch Coal gave up on trying to dig that mine, and they cited something they called regulatory uncertainty, which is sort of a code word for the protests were too much. So essentially that group of ranchers and native people won from all of that hard work that they were willing to do because they felt such a strong commitment to their place. And then the same thing happened at the coal terminal, the export terminal, but for slightly different reasons. In that case, it was the Army Corps of Engineers who recognized the sovereign treaty rights that the Lummi tribe has and recognized that they had the right to say no to that project. So it was inspiring both because I got to witness the wonderful effort that these two groups were putting in, but also it was inspiring to see that they could win. So yeah, in Turtle Mountain Reservation, this is in northern North Dakota, really remote area, beautiful, full of lakes and forests. And there an elder had called the women together because the women had this special responsibility for the water in their tradition. And she said, you know, there's this fracking going on in Fort Berthold and it probably is heading our direction. Before it gets here, what do we think about this? Is this something that we're okay with? And so the women did a bunch of research. They looked at what the geology of fracking and what it could do to their water supply and what was happening in Fort Berthold with those same situations, the man camps and the huge influx of money and the corruption that went with it. And they got pretty alarmed. And they said, no, we don't want this here. So they took it to their tribal council. The tribal council called a community meeting, and they ended up agreeing unanimously to ban fracking from their lands. I happened to be there a couple years after that decision was made and interviewed the tribal chairman. And I asked him, you know, how do you feel about that? Here's this, you know, this opportunity to bring millions of dollars into your, you know, admittedly impoverished tribe. You know, how do you feel about leaving all that money on the table? And he said, well, you know, one thing I've learned is that money doesn't buy happiness. And all you have to do is look at Fort Berthold to understand that. And then he said, and, you know, I'm used to making money the old-fashioned way. I earn it. This guy is a small business, you know, business owner, and he doesn't see a get-rich-quick scheme as really being in the interests of his people or his family. In fact, the tribe is now investing in renewable energy and wind energy. There's so much wind out on the Great Plains, and they're seeing that as a much better long-term solution for their circumstances, and of course that's true of all of us, rather than investing still more in this fossil fuel industry, which is so destructive on so many different levels.
And the ranchers, not only are the Native Americans there investing in alternatives, in other words, not just protesting, but showing the vision of where we can go, but also the ranchers are. Talk about holistic grazing and how that's providing jobs and could combat climate change.
Yeah, that was fascinating. It was not a story I was expecting to stumble on. But there has been for some time this tradition of holistic resource management or holistic grazing. And it's the theory is that if you treat the land the way it had been treated when there were wild buffalo and other wild creatures, you're going to have a much healthier kind of grasslands. And so they raise cattle in a way that's similar to how herds of buffalo or other hoofed animals behave, which is you keep them grouped up. They dig up the soil with their hooves. They defecate all over it and urinate all over it and spread seeds around, by the way. And then they move off to someplace else and the ground recovers, but it recovers in a much more healthy way because of all that fertilization and the disturbance. But it has time to recover. So he's been practicing that method for quite some time and has become a real believer in how much that can benefit the soil. But more recently, he's become aware that you could take that even further if you really come to understand the soil biology and how complex the ecosystems of healthy soil can be, how many different microbes live in the soil and have these amazing relationships, ecosystems that actually sequester huge amounts of carbon when they're healthy. Because what they do is they're growing a lot of grass, and that grass is pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it deep down into the soil. And it turns out that this process is one of the few, besides reforestation, it's one of the few legitimate ways of getting large amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere. So it has a real serious implication in terms of our climate future. And then it has immediate implications for those particular lands, because those lands will hold water better. And with climate change coming along, that's going to be really important as it becomes increasingly the water supply, the rainfall becomes increasingly unstable, that these are lands that can hold water much better and are much less likely then to turn into desert. And that's going to be just incredibly important in the future. And one other implication of all of this is that this is more labor intensive as a way of managing land. It's not going to work to just have huge machinery driving over it as our industrial agriculture usually functions. It takes more effort and more human power. But he said, you know, he started talking about this. He said, you know, we used to think it was such a great accomplishment that somehow fewer people are involved in agriculture. But there's so many young people who would love to work the land and who'd love to learn those skills. And so I think he was onto something, because our whole rural economy, so much of it has been hollowed out because the jobs have disappeared. But what if we started thinking of land management as a skillful occupation in which it takes a lot of people, and you then start rebuilding rural communities on that basis?
And, you know, you say in the book that a lot of the focus of climate activism has been on national and international policy. But what you're showing here is that this local work is having a big impact. Do you think that's still possible in the age of Trump and the Republican and fossil fuel takeover of our government?
You know, I'm really concerned about it, because I think Trump is absolutely serious about revitalizing what is essentially a dying and very destructive part of our economy, the coal economy and the fossil fuel economy more generally. And I think he's doing it for his own immediate profit, because he's invested in those industries, as well as for ideological reasons. But in terms of, if you're actually interested in bringing in jobs, renewable energy is much more likely. Renewable energy and converting our infrastructure to be more energy efficient is far more likely to create large numbers of jobs than trying to bring back these dying industries. So I am really concerned about how much damage he can do. His recent decision to try to get the KXL pipeline and the DAPL pipeline built in spite of all the opposition, I think, is appalling. I think it's going to be a question of relooking at some of the tactics. And I still think the local opposition is going to be absolutely essential. For example, in the DAPL pipeline situation, we've heard a lot about the native opposition. And I actually had a chance to go out there and spend a few weeks covering that. But just recently, a number of the farmers who have sold easements to their land to the Dakota Access Pipeline have taken that pipeline to court and said they weren't treated fairly and they don't want to see this go through after all. So it's this combination, I think, again, of place-based folks, both native and non-native, really figuring out what rights they have and standing up for those rights, and often doing it most effectively when they stand together.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Sarah Van Gelder about her book. It's just a terrific book, The Revolution Where You Live. Now, let's move on to the Rust Belt, because there also you find people working together. I'd never seen this term before, a do-it-together economy, not a DIT instead of a DIY. So you went to the Rust Belt cities of the Midwest to find a growing cooperative movement. And let's start out with the New Era Windows Co-op. I mean, I think many of our listeners will probably remember the Republic Windows and Doors issue that happened. This was a place that threatened, well, in fact, did close down its operations without, you know, any proper kind of notice to its workers. Tell us that story and what happened to Republic Windows and Doors.
So the Republic Windows and Doors was a regular window and door factory. The owner decided, as so many factory owners do, that they can make more money by outsourcing the work. So they plan to close that factory. In this case, they didn't pay the workers their back wages, and so the workers occupied until they were paid. That turned into a battle that became nationally known, as you mentioned, and they ended up compromising by selling out to a new owner who offered to keep the place open. So these factory workers kept their jobs, and they, you know, they were good with that, but they were also aware that this could happen again. So they started looking into their options, and it's true, this new owner also decided to shutter the factory after a few years, and this time they occupied with the idea that they would buy the factory. And so they were able to prevent the new owner from just selling off all the components of the factory and instead got the right to buy it. So now this group of people who previously had been factory workers and who our society tells us, you know, they don't have MBAs, how would they manage this factory? And actually they're doing just fine because, in fact, they had been doing the work. And it was so interesting talking to them. One of the things that that one of them said is, you know, we used to have these ideas about how we could make production work better. But, you know, our bosses weren't interested in what we had to say. They just said, go back to work. And now when we have a good idea, we can talk among ourselves and we can implement it. And he said, and here's another advantage we have. We don't have to come up with enough money to pay huge executive salaries. All we have to have is enough to pay ourselves enough, and we have to have enough to put back into the business and to be paying off our loans. But we don't have to be paying off these huge executive salaries, and we don't have to be paying off Wall Street either for the profits that the investors hope to get. So they're able to, with a different kind of an ethos, one that's focused on enough, on certainly making a living wage, but not having to make a killing. They're able to make a go of it, at least so far. They're also working with investors who have the same view, that they don't have to make a killing. They need to be paid off too, and they should get some interest for it. But they don't have to get the biggest profits. So it's so interesting seeing how that switches things, how it becomes possible to do things when you don't have to be maximizing the amount you extract from a business. You can actually think of it as something that's worth investing in for its own worth as some, you know, a business that's providing energy efficient windows and doors and jobs for a bunch of people.
That's a great story. And it reminded me actually way back in, I think, when was it? 1969, I worked in a window and door factory in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I remember that I was figured out a way to actually double my production without any real extra effort on my part. And the foreman came along and said, why are you doing it that way? And I said, well, I think this is a better way to do it. And he said, you're not paid to think, you're paid to work.
Wow.
Never forgotten that. So, yes, workers could probably do it better than. So then you also saw, the union movement has been much criticized for leaving many rank and file workers in the dust, but they're actually getting involved with the co-ops, with cooperative businesses. Talk about how that happens and the Cincinnati Union Co-op Initiative.
Right. I mean, I think there's a wide range of ways that unions have related to rank and file workers, some of whom have, I think some of the unions have been quite remarkable about how well they've done in organizing unorganized workers. But on the whole, the union movement has been losing a lot of ground as big corporations find ways to either shut them down or to, you know, these right-to-work laws or to move production overseas. So they've been losing a lot of ground, especially in the private sector. So in Cincinnati, there's a couple of unions who've been cooperating with community groups and with faith groups, people who want to see the economy thrive in that city. And they've been developing this notion of worker union co-ops. So they're worker-owned, so those jobs will not disappear overseas. They're unionized, so they're still part of the union movement, and the union provides things like health insurance and help making sure that the HR policies are really good for the workers. And it seems to be a growing idea, an idea that's growing in the union movement. They had a conference shortly after I was there of people from all over the country who are interested in this model. In Cincinnati, what they have is a couple of farms that are co-ops and worker-owned. They have a food hub where they buy food from those farms, but also from other local farms and sell the food to hospitals and schools and so forth, places that are long-term, steady consumers of those items to make sure there's a market for the food that those farmers produce. And then they also are working on rehabbing an old derelict grocery store and rebuilding it into a food co-op in one of the neighborhoods that lacks access to good, healthy food. So that's what they're doing in Cincinnati. They have one or two other smaller co-ops as well. But it's really interesting to see how that movement may spread. The Mondragon Cooperatives in Spain, which is a giant movement of thousands of employees and dozens of different enterprises, they've also been collaborating with this movement. And I just heard recently they're actually sending someone to be located there in Cincinnati to help people develop this model.
Wow, that's great. Now, talking about food, you also went to Grow Power, is that right, in Milwaukee and Chicago? Well, you actually went to Chicago. I've spoken to Will Allen, who began this a long time ago, doing Sea Change Radio. So tell us about what's happening in the, you know, what Donald Trump still calls the inner city in Milwaukee and in Chicago.
Well, I visited the Growing Power in Chicago, and that is run by Erica Allen, who's Will Allen's daughter. And they have several sites around Chicago where they have farms going on. I visited one that's outside of a warehouse. They have a warehouse that is used for growing worms, growing fish, growing mushrooms on the inside, but around it, on the territory around it, they're growing vegetables, they're raising animals. And it's interesting because this is an area that has been contaminated by years of industrial production nearby. So they don't feel safe about using the soil that's there as is. So what happens is that every day, truckloads of organic waste are delivered by the city and truckloads of wood chips, and they mix that up into layers and compost it. And then months later, they harvest that, and it's this beautiful, rich soil full of nutrients. And they put that on top of the soil, and that's what they use as the bed for their plantings. So they're actually rebuilding the soil of this area and growing all this fresh food. They use hoop houses, which are sort of like temporary greenhouses, to extend the growing season. And then they take the produce that they harvest, they distribute in various ways, including at a farm stand right there in Chicago. But they also fill up an old city bus that they've painted in all these beautiful, bright Growing Power colors and murals. And they take it to different health centers and senior centers and schools, and they sell the produce out of the bus so that people in these neighborhoods who ordinarily don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables can have that kind of access. And, you know, that's so interesting when you think about that, just the question of access to fresh food. If you pay any attention at all to the research on health, we really need to eat fresh fruits and vegetables to stay healthy. If all that we have access to is you know, the corner convenience store filled with food that's full of fat and preservatives and sugar, there's no way to be healthy and to eat that full time. So these kinds of innovations within cities that are bringing people fresh fruits and vegetables, they're so important for people's well-being. And there's so many other things they do. You know, food is so much at the core of how we relate to one another. We love to break bread together. It connects us to our culture. We like to cook the foods of home, wherever home is to us. It's a great way to share culture when people share the culinary treats of whatever their tradition is. It's a way we connect with our children because we share food with them and talk to them about what it means to us. And it's also a way that we connect back to the land because, of course, food comes right out of the soil and right out of the water of our particular place. So I think food has, it just has a tremendous number of dimensions to it. And that's so different to think of food that way than to just think of it as a commodity. You know, how can you extract the most possible food out of an acre of land, for example, or out of an hour of human labor? It's so much more interesting when you think of food in all those dimensions. And it's also one of the places where the exploitation of labor is the worst. In the food industry, everywhere from meatpacking to farm workers to restaurant servers, food can be some of the worst jobs in our society, and yet it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be if it's done with that kind of consciousness of a place like Growing Power.
And one place that you visited that brings together both the idea of a cooperative and a farm, food growing food in this way, is La Minga Farm Cooperative in Kentucky, of all places. Tell us about that.
Yeah, La Minga is outside Louisville, Kentucky, and it was started by a couple of Central American immigrants, one from El Salvador, one from Honduras. And they came to Louisville and started growing food that they were used to from home and realized that, yes, they could do that because they both came from farming backgrounds, but it was hard to grow 20-some different crops and complicated, and it was kind of a lonely venture. So they decided to expand the farming effort to a whole community of people. So they now have this collective of farmers. They each agree to grow three crops and then to share what they grow with everybody else. So it's another place where instead of thinking about the most efficient way to grow food, they're also thinking about all these other values. Again, the connection to place, the connection to their cultures because they grow foods that especially are the ones that they love to eat, and connection to one another so that instead of feeling isolated as the newcomers in town, they have now this group of friends, this group of people who collaborate on this project. And I happened to be there for their harvest festival, and I was just struck by how much joy and how much pleasure they had unleashed by working together and collaborating together and sharing together.
So Sarah Van Gelder, you don't just talk about economies of place in the revolution where you live, but you also tackle the issue of justice. You know, we live in a society where vast numbers of our people are incarcerated, mass incarceration, where the only growing industry in many of these rural areas is the prison industry. Talk about the Restorative Justice Project in Harrison, Virginia.
Yeah, I interviewed one of the police officers in Harrisonburg, Virginia, who's really interested in the question of restorative justice. And restorative justice is really visible in Harrisonburg because Eastern Mennonite University is located there, and they've been teaching different kinds of aspects of the restorative justice philosophy for some time. So the police department there was very aware, as I think police departments are across the country, that they're being challenged for their practices, especially how they're treating people of color, especially how they're treating African Americans. And as you know, the Black Lives Matter movement has come up to challenge that. And what he had to say was, you know, one of the ways that we're able to function is if we have legitimacy, if people understand that we're there to protect the community and that we're being fair. And we need to work harder on that, is essentially what he told me. We have to work harder to earn that trust and earn that legitimacy. So one of the ways they can do it is through restorative justice. He takes it right from when police officers stop someone on the street and how important it is that those stops be done with respect, that the police officer be trained to listen, not just to talk, and to, you know, to treat each person who they talk to with respect. So that's the first part of that process. And then if there is a charge of a crime of some kind, there are situations in which rather than simply take it in front of a judge and try to establish guilt or innocence, there's this other process within the restorative justice framework, which is to say, you know, there's a victim and an offender in this situation, but oftentimes it's a more complex situation. So let's try to understand this from everybody's point of view. When we establish that somebody has done something wrong, and basically these kinds of restorative justice circles only happen when someone has admitted that they did something that was not right. So let's look at how we can make reparations, how that person can make reparations to whoever they wronged. He gave me the example of a pastor who had come to him who had hired one of his parishioners to work for him and then later found out that she had been embezzling money. So, you know, one possibility is simply to charge her with the crime and she'd go serve time in prison and, you know, it might cause all sorts of hardships to her family and maybe that's the right thing to do. But maybe there's another option which could include her paying reparations and apologizing and so forth, but also trying to make things right for everyone in the end so that her family doesn't have to suffer and so that the money is paid back to her employer. So I found that very interesting because I've heard of the restorative justice efforts underway in various settings, but he was the first person I'd ever heard talk of it from the point of view of the police department.
Well, finally, as you drove back on the last miles home, and you were reflecting on your journal, a journey of, was it 12,000 miles?
Mm-hmm.
What came to you as being the key lessons that you learned at that point? I loved, for example, how you talk about the Archimedean point, basically, Archimedes, who spoke about, you know, where I am, I can move the world. You know,
right.
That somehow the place you are is a lever that can move, the entire globe.
That's right. Yeah, give me a place to stand and I can... Yeah. Now, Archimedes was talking about the use of a lever, which is... The use of a lever is an interesting metaphor. But I also got to thinking about how much more power we have in our communities than a lot of people realize. Because I was talking to some of the people you might categorize as the most powerless in our society, people in impoverished and remote Indian reservations, people in some of the abandoned cities and, you know, where the poverty is the highest, people in Appalachia, people in the South. So I was talking to some of the people that you would consider the most powerless, and yet there was something about those people who had taken a stand based on where they lived and taken a stand for their natural environment, for their community, in connection with one another. And in some cases, that was mainly focused on resisting things that could harm them, like a new huge strip mine in Montana. And in other cases, it was taking a stand to say, we can do better, and we can recreate the kind of community that we want in our own communities by taking leadership ourselves. In either case, there was something about doing that as a place-based community that felt to me like really powerful in ways that I think we've forgotten. I think we now so often think of power as, well, if we can, you know, thousands of us can get together and sign a petition, or if we can maybe write a check, I'll write a check to the same political candidate or to the same nonprofit that can advocate for us. But it's almost like we're outsourcing our power to someone else and hoping they'll do the right thing. And what I was finding is that people were forgetting how much power they have where they are to make things happen in their own communities.
Well, that's so powerful, as is your book. It is The Revolution Where You Live, Sarah Van Gelder. It's just been delightful to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.